Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 14th of October and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast with me, David Taylor from the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily news service at constructionindex.co.uk. How are you doing there, Phil?
I'm doing okay, David. How are things at your end?
Yeah, we're fine. And a bit of news this week, I think, about my favourite mega project, Phil. It's all going swimmingly, I understand. Is that right?
Well, this is HS2 you're talking about, of course. Just yesterday...
Yes, of course. You know what a fan I am.
The HS2 minister, Andrew Stevenson, whose only job is to make sure that HS2 stays on the rails, under the... I don't know if it's embedded in the legislation or it's just an agreement, but every 6 months he reports back to the House of Commons with an update of what's going on and how it's going. And it's quite interesting, some of the numbers. HS2's estimated cost, or target cost of the whole thing, £40.3 billion for Phase 1, I should say, not the whole thing. Phase 1, London-Birmingham stretch. Mm-hmm. The target cost of £40.3 billion. Well, they've already spent or allocated more than half of it. £9.6 billion has actually been spent out of that 40.3, and a further 11.5 is contracted or contracted. So only £13.9 billion has yet to be contracted, and that remains an HS2 estimate.
Yeah.
Those numbers don't add up. There's some other number in there which is escaping.
There are too many numbers. Too many numbers. My eyes are swimming.
But the point is nearly a quarter of it's already been spent on phase one, which is interesting. And I tell you what the gap is. There's a contingency. The £5.3 billion contingency buffer for surprises, which it looks like they're going to need, because the other bit of news that the minister broke yesterday was that. Mm-hmm. The enabling works have gone £400 million over budget. That's primarily a lot of demolition, where they found more asbestos than they were expecting. So that costs a lot more money. £400 million more, that's a lot of surprises there. And they call them cost pressures. The other cost pressure of £400 million is around Euston. Euston Station is still subject to a lot of... design work. They've gone back to, I would say, the drawing board, but they're having a bit of a rethink about how to make mm-hmm. Euston work. And they might, Euston hasn't necessarily overrun by £400 million. They might get that back, but equally, there might be additional costs of £400 million on Euston that they're worried about. So we have to see what happens there.
Is anybody surprised that things are beginning to go over budget?
Well, technically, it depends what your budget is. I mean, HST has its own target cost with a £5.3 billion
contingency
buffer for contingencies in there. Yeah. So really, all things being equal, it reckons it can do it for about £35 billion, phase one. Hmm. And if it does it for £35 billion, let's say, we come in £5 billion under budget. No, it doesn't. You come in on budget, but without spending your contingency.
Yes.
And then there's another number, which is the what they call the total envelope or something.
Back of an envelope.
The total funding envelope set by the government is £44.6 billion. So that's about £4.3 billion over the target cost. You have a total funding envelope. I don't know what's in the total funding envelope, which isn't in the target cost, but there's another budget, which if they come in under under 44.6, they'll still be able to say, we came in under the total funding envelope. So there's three ways they can beat budget, I guess. And these are all 2019 prices, of course. So when we're talking about this in 2033, when the thing opens, it won't be 44.6 or 40 billion. It'll be in 2033 numbers.
Yes.
Unless inflation stays zero over the next 15 years, it'll be a lot bigger number than that because of inflation.
Yeah.
The final googly in there is that all these numbers don't include extra costs being incurred to meet the COVID operating regime. The minister said that the contractors working on the project are coping pretty well with the new COVID operating procedures, but they haven't actually calculated what the additional cost implications are of that, and that'll come out and within the next 6 months. So there'll be another HS2 costs increase again because of COVID story to come out.
Yeah, that's true.
We don't know what that is yet.
Are they going to sort of, do you think they'll attribute that to HS2, or will that cost overrun be sort of, I don't know, funneled away somewhere else so that they say that this doesn't count? When we come to do the final figures, this won't count because it's COVID.
I don't think they can't attribute it to anything. I mean, they can only say it's because of COVID. They can't say it's not part of the HS2 spend.
Right.
But in the same way, they can say, not our fault, Gov, we didn't know there was going to be asbestos there. They can quite legitimately say, not our fault, Gov, we didn't know there was going to be a global pandemic screwing things up.
Although presumably they would have had a much better idea about the asbestos than they would have had about the pandemic. Because presumably they have done a bit of sort of ground investigation, one hopes.
Yes.
I suppose these things are always a surprise, aren't they? But there you are. Right, so that's
HS2. Well, it remains hugely controversial. And final thing in HS2, you see pictures of Swampy. We mentioned Swampy the other week. He's back in the news. He's been protesting, climbing a tree.
Really?
What's his name? Dan Hooper, I think, is his real name.
I didn't know that.
He'll always be Swampy. He's actually joined the protests and been pulled down from a tree. There are now apparently official climbing police. There's a, you know, you have mounted police, you now have climbing police.
Really?
Especially to go up trees to...
This is getting more interesting. I had no idea. How old is Swampy now? He must be about 50, isn't he?
No, I don't think he's that old. I think nearer 40. I don't know. 40, give or take a couple of years.
Yeah, still young enough to shin up a tree then.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And run away vertically from policemen.
Righty-ho. So what else has been exercising you this week, Phil?
Again, keeping an eye on goings on in Parliament, there was a debate on housing and planning last week.
Yeah.
All the furore. I mean, every MP has got a constituency which they are duty-bound to defend, lest they get kicked out of office by their voters next time around. So there's obviously a lot of people saying, we know, and we support the government's target of building 300,000 new homes a year, but they can't be built in my patch because it's the wrong place.
Yes, exactly.
And there are good reasons. I mean, wherever you put them, it's perfectly valid to say this is the wrong place. And it's very, I mean, where would you build 300,000? And this is just in England, mind you.
300,000 houses.
Scotland or Wales. 300,000 houses in England. Where are you going to put them?
Well, if you'd asked me where I was going to put three houses, I know exactly where I'd put them. But 300,000 is a different matter. I've no idea. I would probably try and home in on a few brownfield sites. Maybe, I don't know, this is going off on a tangent, but I always wondered why the former coal fields, when Margaret Thatcher dismantled the mining industry, I always felt that really the communities in those former mining villages and places like that weren't properly served. And I know that there were government attempts to regenerate areas up in the northeast, for example, and some of them were successful. But I think that probably better use could have been made of some of these former industrial sites. And I suppose that's where I would put houses. The problem is, of course, that a lot of the time you can put the houses there and you can tell people to move into them. But if there's no work, they're not going to move.
you can, but there's no point building houses
unless
where people don't want to live and can't work.
No.
Now, when we have HS2, of course, you know, everyone can live in Birmingham and work in London.
Yeah.
In fact, you probably even live in Leeds and work in London or vice versa. But it seems to me the problem is housing is essentially, I mean, there's a lot of public sector housing, but essentially it's a market, private sector housing.
Yes.
And therefore, the more of it is, economics 101, the more houses there are, prices come down, and the more scarce the commodity is, the more expensive it is.
Yeah.
And there seems to be a lot of political push to level up and the north and, you know, build more houses in the north of England. instead of in the southeast. But in the southeast is where house prices are hugely expensive.
Yes.
I mean, they're still expensive in the north compared to salaries, but I don't think the differential is going wrong. But if you're going to build more houses in the north, isn't that going to make houses in the southeast
even more expensive? Yeah.
And make it even harder for anyone, you know, wanting to get a job in London. Well, maybe they don't want people to get jobs in London. They want people to move out of London up north. Mm. But, you know, chucking up a huge, great housing estates in the north of England, I don't think is going to tempt people to move out of London there.
No, that's true.
If the jobs aren't there. And the jobs tend to be in the southeast.
I mean, one example of that, the one example that springs to mind is the BBC moving a lot of their operations up to Salford. That appears to have worked. I mean, I've heard on the grapevine that a lot of people who were supposed to be moving up to Salford actually just dug their heels in and said, "No, I live in the south," and refused to do so. But we've got Media City up in Manchester now, and that's been a success, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I think your point about the BBC people who didn't want to move. I mean, some of them might have just been wedded to the southeast because that's where their life was. But a bigger factor in these times is that people have families, and if your other half has got a very good job near where you currently live, and your children are settled in school of all different ages, all coming up to different exams, and you don't want to pull them out of, you know, three different schools or something, simply moving from, you know, 200 miles across the country because your job is moving is straightforward, or can be straightforward for a lot of people, but for many others,
yeah, it's not.
It's nigh on impossible. But no, there'd been a lot of talk about, I mean, there's talk not so long ago about whether the House of Lords should be moved to York, and that sort of kite was floated for a week or two before it was pulled down. And there are always people saying, I mean, Michael Heseltine was always a big advocate of this, moving central government departments and civil servants out of London.
Yeah.
And this is, but it's not, I mean, it may work out in the end, but it's not without enormous problems. I think it was the Office of National Statistics, Office for National Statistics, moved from somewhere Londonish to, I think it's now in South Wales. Swansea, is it?
Cardiff? I'm not sure. I didn't know that.
I think it's somewhere there. And as part of the move, they lost a lot of staff who didn't want to make the move. And for a while, there seemed to be quite a hiatus of ONS statistics being complete gibberish. And there was an awful, I mean, certainly the construction numbers, and it took a while for them to completely rethink how they're going to do the numbers, because a lot of these statistics gathering is more art than science, and the chief artists were no longer around.
Yes, I remember that, actually. Yeah. That was only a couple of years ago, wasn't it?
I think it's a couple of years ago in how and I think about it. A younger person might say it was actually 10 years ago or more.
No, really?
possibly even 20.
All right. Okay.
Quick Google. Shall we have a quick Google? When did ONS move?
But I do know that a couple of years ago, the Construction Products Association, for example, was constantly having to bat away allegations from the ONS about construction growth, and the numbers simply weren't adding up.
Yes. Okay. Call it up. Report in the FT from 5 years ago say the UK Statistical Office moving to Wales ended in mistakes, basically. The former deputy of the Bank of England said undeniably suffered when it moved to Newport in 2007.
Oh, 13
years
ago. Blimey. God.
So, as I say, for a 50-something-year-old, that's a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
anyone younger or anyone rational, it's 13 years ago.
Okay. Yes, there's this debate about planning in the House. I noticed that Theresa May suddenly re-emerged unexpectedly to criticise the government, didn't she?
Well, it sounded like she was criticising specifically Dominic Cumming and really taking the piss out of reliance on algorithms.
Yeah.
Because the thing that's got all the headlines is that there's now this algorithm, which is a great way of describing an invented system that no one understands apart from Dominic Cumming or some other pointy-headed person somewhere. And the algorithm says, it's like that little written computer operator person. The algorithm says that if you're in such and such a county, you have to have so many thousands of houses built with little regard for whatever's been going on there.
Hmm.
Yeah, did you read Theresa May's speech?
No, I didn't read it. I've seen a few highlights.
I had a read of it, and Hansard is a much better read than people give it credit for, actually. It's worth having a look at Hansard occasionally. There's some fun stuff in there. But her point.
So what does she say?
She's saying that the new housing algorithm does not deliver a single extra home, because developers will get they constantly put in planning permission applications, and they get more and more planning permissions, but don't actually build any more homes because of market forces. Mm. They'll only build homes that they can sell at the right price. But there's another issue or concern about the planning reforms, not just the algorithm, but again, you solve one problem, you create another. The small builders had been lobbying government for ages, and there's this big fear that the big house builders have got this oligopoly and they control the market. And not very long ago, it used to be a much bigger slice of the market was taken up by little local builders building developments of, 5, 10, 15 houses on little corner patches. And that kind of market's disappeared because the planning reg tape, the money needed, the capital, upfront capital needed, it all becomes too much for the small builder. And so the government's quite keen to get the small builders back on board, good thing. But one of the ways they're suggesting of doing that is changing the rules for sites of less than 49 units, I think. For smaller sites, you won't have to meet the obligations to build 25% of the new houses affordable.
That's affordable, yeah.
So effectively, affordable housing is a way of house builders subsidising local authorities, I guess. And so the planning proposals is that will go by the way.
Hmm.
The Local Government Association is saying, for its part, that, there's going to be an awful lot of affordable houses not being built, because they calculated that over the past four years,
apparently,
there were just nearly 120,000 private homes built on sites of less than 49 or fewer units, less than 50 units. Therefore, this would have had to include about 30,000 affordable homes being built for either rent or purchase. So without the current rule, you'd be losing 30,000 affordable homes over the past 5 years. In other words, moving forwards, there are going to be thousands of affordable homes that won't be built. And that's what they're concerned about. Theresa May made the point, I think it's her, it might have been someone else who made the point, that one of the other MPs in Parliament was saying that if you make sites smaller than 50 units exempt from affordable housing requirements, the big developers will just game the system. They'll chop up a site into five bits, and it'll be five different sites of 50 units each.
They'll
target 50. They'll get around it.
But I wonder, how long is this requirement for 25% or whatever the percentage is of affordable homes on a particular site or particular development? How long has that been around? That's about the last 20 years, or is it? I'm showing my age. It's probably the last 50 years. But it's been a requirement for a long time, and I just wonder how successful it's been, because I think, one person's affordable home is another person's palace. And there must be, there's probably an algorithm for it in actual fact, how you calculate the average affordable house price compared to the average local salary or wage. And I can remember a long time ago, who was the Deputy Prime Minister under Tony Blair?
I'd almost
forgotten his name. John Prescott. I wonder where he is now. I remember him saying an affordable house costs £60,000. And I don't know whether or not that was just...
Get a beach hut.
Exactly. I don't know whether or not that was just a throwaway remark, or whether he was advised that that was a real figure. But the house builders seemed to seize upon that. And everywhere you looked, house builders were saying, we're building so many houses, which will cost the buyer only £60,000. It didn't matter where in the country it was. And of course, locality is a major factor in total house prices. And of course, I imagine that average salaries down in my part of the country are probably a lot lower than average salaries in your part of the country. So £60,000 is different for somebody down in Devon to somebody up in the Weald of Kent. But certainly, I've seen small developments locally where you look at the detail and they say, we've got sort of 25 executive homes, including a proportion for shared ownership or affordable rent or whatever it is, and you look at the details and you think, you couldn't afford that. You know, you'd have to be on...
No, I hate... the use of this word affordable is such a...
It's a bit patronising, really, isn't it? Because, as I said, one person's affordable is another person's, cool, I wish, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know whether or not that this requirement has actually had its time, and that we should rethink how we deliver homes that people can actually afford. So anyway, I think there's a big question mark over the whole concept of affordable homes, and I think it's probably about time that we revisited it and thought again. I don't think that the house building industry in this country is what it should be in any case. I think that it probably needs a lot of reform, but that's a different matter. Okay, Phil, have we finished that topic? Are we going to move on to something else? There's some other interesting...
I have no answers to that.
Yeah, there's some very interesting things happening here as well. Now, I understand that one of our most respected manufacturers has got into a bit of hot water recently, has been had all sorts of mud slung at it.
Down. I think...
Go on, tell it. Give us a lowdown.
Someone's trying to drag JCB into hot water. That's what's happening here. And it's actually, I've discovered, it's not a new issue. Campaigning organisations will frequently try and lean on big business. When you and I were students, it was all about South Africa.
Boycotting Cape apples and things like that. Yeah.
Don't bank with Barclays Bank.
That's right.
They're all this sort of stuff. In fact, Barclays Banks were banned from most student union campuses.
I think they were, This
is slightly different. I mean, this is several steps removed from that. JCB, like many manufacturers of not just construction machinery, manufacturers of any sort of product, its products are sold in Israel. And as it happens, its products have been used in Israel on highly contentious projects in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
There is an organization called Lawyers for Palestinian Human Rights who have complained that JCB is in breach of OECD human rights guidelines because it's allowing its machines to be used in this bad way. Now, JCB, it seems to me, is clearly not allowing or not allowing. It's nothing to do with how its machines are being used. In the same way that when cash points are ram raided and taken out by a JCB digger, JCB shouldn't be
yes.
charged with bank robbery. And if gun manufacturers are free of any accusations that their guns are killing people, how a digger maker, excavator or backhoe manufacturer can be accused of being in breach of human rights, I think it's most unfair and frankly balmy.
Well, this outfit, they were quite specific, weren't they, in their allegations? I think there were five points.
Well, they're a group of lawyers, so they know what they're doing. Their goal is, I hope they don't want to see JCB suffer. They just want to make headlines and perhaps apply a bit of pressure to governments around the world and to try and, advance their cause however they can. It's not just this particular organisation. Amnesty International and War on Want, over the past few years, have made noises about, manufacturers and machinery that's been used in these places.
Yeah.
But the specific charges that these lawyers brought was that they're contributing to adverse human rights impacts by selling products that facilitates another entity to cause harms. Well, that was thrown out immediately. There's an office of the Department of International Trade whose job it is to monitor the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises and to handle complaints, essentially.
Yeah.
And it said, no case to answer. The lawyers said that JCB failed to stop the sale of products. They said that JCB should have stopped these machines going there. No, that's not their fault at all. But more sort of detail, where JCB does seem to be open to attack, possibly, we don't know whether this is true or not yet, but where the UK government office have sort of said, we need to know a bit more about this, whether they have a human rights policy in place, and whether they carried out human rights due diligence.
That could be where the problem is, because I think
Well, you know, the thing is, we spoke on the phone yesterday. It seems to me that if you're any sort of company now of any size, you've always got to have these boilerplate statements of your environmental policy, your human rights policy, your diversity statement, and I don't know, apparently now you've got to have a human rights statement.
Yeah.
This is suggesting. I mean, you would have thought most of the human rights of people that certainly work for JCB would be covered by all their other corporate statements and policies that they've got written down.
Yeah.
But the fundamental point of whether it's Caterpillar or Komatsu or JCB being blamed for what their machines are doing, especially when most of the time these machines aren't even sold by the manufacturer, they're sold through intermediaries over whom they have no control apart from a agency relationship. And other times, these machines might be third or fourth hand.
Of course.
They haven't even been sold by JCB intermediaries.
It's flag waving, isn't it? It is a way of raising awareness of an issue. If you're a campaigning organisation, you're going to do that. It is a bit unfair. I think it's a bit disingenuous, actually, to make this look like some sort of legal challenge to JCB, when in fact it's OECD guidelines. I don't think there's any legal basis against which JCB could be judged, is there? I mean, these are guidelines. I mean, it's not required by law. Is it quite required by law to have a human rights policy? If it is, it's news to me.
I don't know what the force of the OECD guidelines are. Maybe the lawyers are hoping to test them.
Yeah.
But interesting one to pick up on. I mean, we've seen it before with crane manufacturers. About 10 years ago or so in Iran, there was quite a lot of photos in the press, or particularly on nastier websites and so on, more graphic photos of cranes being used for public hangings.
Yes.
In Iran. And a lot of crane manufacturers were urged to stop selling to Iran. I think they did. A lot of them pulled out, although they've since moved back in again in more recent times.
But I don't think that's a new thing. That's been going on for a long time, because I can remember an American crane company, 30 years ago probably, complaining about the bad publicity that shortly after the Iranian Revolution, so that was back in the 70s, wasn't it, the late 70s, the bad publicity of having pictures of their machines being used as gibbets. But there's nothing they can do about that. As you say, the cranes were already there.
Especially when there's a very thriving used equipment market out there.
Yeah.
And if, some mad tyrant wants to go to the back pages of a used equipment magazine and buy himself an old digger or
I don't think anybody can justifiably point the finger at JCB for the way the Israelis use machines built in roaster. Anyway,
no, JCB are innocent, so are Caterpillar, Komatsu, and the rest.
Yeah, absolutely.
And finally, Esther.
Well, this is an interesting story which has been sort of bubbling under for a long time. You've reported a lot on it, actually, Phil. When is a contractor not a contractor? And when is and I've often wondered this, actually, when is a labour-only contractor a building firm? And it's a bit like the is a Jaffa cake a cake or a biscuit test. We don't really know. And it has to be decided in the courts. Well, the courts have decided. You know all about this, Phil, so tell us what's been going on.
A Jaffa cake is a cake until it gets a tax break if it calls itself a biscuit, or it's the other way around.
Well, I do know what the eventual ruling was on that, so I might divulge it later. But back to the point.
This story, the reason why I'm talking about it now is because I posted a story on the financial results of a company called Hudson Contract. Now, technically, Hudson Contract... I say technically. I'm not going to use the word technically, because there lies the hub. To most people, Hudson Contract is a firm of 30 accountants, bookkeepers, auditors, who handle the payroll services of something like 20,000 self-employed, or are they self-employed?
No.
Construction operatives.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you would think of at first glance, a firm of accountants. But according to the courts, they're not a firm of accountants. They don't have just 30 employees who come into the office each day. I don't know if they still come into the office at the moment in the current environment, but they don't have 30 people who identify as employees of Hudson Contract. Mm. They actually have, it has now been legally ruled earlier this year, twice, they actually have 20,000 or so employees. Everyone on their books, everyone who you or I might think of as a client is not a client, but an employee. And this is all to do with the tax system, the construction industry scheme and all of that, and a way for the Treasury's been trying to sort out the whole business of bogus self-employment in the construction industry and how things are accounted for. Mm. And we've talked before about this is all to do with the strange nature of the construction labour force, that they move from job to job, and if one big contractor moves into town to take on one project, they can move on to that site.
Yeah.
And someone else moves in next door, they can move on to that site and on a self-employed basis. And it's strange sort of way it largely works for the construction industry. But the upshot is that Hudson Contract, according to the courts, has got 20,030 employees, and which makes its turnover last year of nearly 1.4 billion, this is year to 5th of April 2020, 1.4 billion, which makes it just about one of the top 10 construction companies in the UK.
Certainly one of the top 20. I don't think it's in the top 10.
We discussed the other week in our podcast, that, you know, your top 100 rankings.
Yes.
And who was up there. It's getting close to the top 10, but I think other when the next numbers come out, you'll find that some of the big companies' turnover has shrunk, whether it's Galliford Try because they've sold their housing business off. Interserv will have shrunk because it sold off its, or it is in the process of selling off its facilities management business, or a lot of it. And other companies will have shrunk because of COVID. So you might see Hudson Contract sneaking just about into the top 10. But
it's
thereabouts, the sort of Waits
13 and a half
Dixon
at the moment between, yeah, Waits and Wilmot Dixon. That's right, yeah. So Hudson Contract is holding out and saying, no, the courts are wrong. We're not a contractor. And it's appealing, isn't it?
Well, the only reason it matters whether you call Hudson Contract a contractor or not is because if it's a contractor, it has to pay the Construction Industry Training Board levy.
Yeah.
If it's not a contract, if it's a firm of accountants, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
This all went to, this is all, Court of Appeal heard this in, I think it was March this year, whether or not Hudson Contract was liable for the CITB levy. First of all, the court said, yep, you're liable, you're a contractor, you've got 20,000 employees or whatever the number is. They appealed it and they lost that again and said, no, you've got to pay the levy. Now, this is quite a big sum they've got to pay. For 3 years back payment, the CITB is claiming more than £27 million.
Oh, I bet they'd love that, wouldn't they? Now, if I was the CITB, God.
No one pays £27 million. So, naturally, Hudson Contract are spending lots both sides spend lots on lawyers, and Hudson Contract have been doing surveys and campaigns and have quite naturally really got it in for the CITB. It's an interesting and lively battle. And to be honest, it's a shame that it's between CITB and Hudson Contract Services, because it's almost like it's not their fault. It's the Treasury that set the rules up, and they're both sort of, you know, falling victims behind it.
Yeah.
The Construction Industry Training Board, I don't think, will go after an individual self-employed construction operative saying, you know, you're a one-man band company, give us your share, because I don't think, but they wouldn't be liable. My sympathies are slightly with Hudson on this, but they've insulated themselves fairly well. The actual company that owes Construction Industry Training Board all this money, it's called Hudson Contract Services. It still exists, but its operations of that company were transferred to a new company called Hudson Contract Limited, which is the parent company. And they're both owned by the same people, and there's no sort of shenanigans. It's just a way of if they absolutely do end up having to pay this, my assumption is they can just fold the company and say we're bankrupt with £27 million debts. Sorry, CITB. I would assume that the new entity is legally protected.
Yes.
But I'm not a financial lawyer or corporate lawyer, so I don't know the details of that. But that's my assumption of what it's all about.
Well, I haven't examined the arguments on either side in any great detail. But I mean, just I would have thought that it should be quite easy to decide whether or not Hudson Contract is an employer, if it is actually, if these, because if it's liable, as the CITB claims, then those 20,000 operatives are employees of Hudson Contract, and then therefore not self-employed contractors, as they individually seem to assume. And so that changes everything. That changes their tax status and all the rest of it. And I would have thought if they are employees of Hudson Contract, then surely Hudson Contract must pay them holiday pay and sick pay. And I'm surely we could find that out quite easily, couldn't we?
I would have to ask that. I don't know. It might. I don't know. But the Lord Justice Underhill, I have this quote from the appeal court, said, Hudson is, after all, a sophisticated form of labour-only subcontractor on terms that remove risk in relation to construction activity. I think we have to assume the courts have got it right in terms of interpreting the law. And I think we need to have Hudson Contract in our top 100 next year, David, please.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay, then. I'm going to have to make a decision on this, aren't I? But I'm not going to do it right now.
Well, the courts have ruled. You don't. You can't. Yeah. You lose.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I suppose if you were to argue that Hudson Contract was a labour-only subcontractor, it was supplying labour in, if you like, in a... an abstract way, not the actual people. It wasn't actually supplying the people, it was supplying their labour. You could probably get away with arguing that they are a contractor and that this is a product that they are marketing.
But to my way of thinking about what a contractor is, it's the organisation that takes on the risk for the contract. If I want a power station built, I go to a contractor and say, build me a power station.
Yeah.
I might say, design and build me a power station, or say, meet my architect, he's designed it, go build me a power station. And he's my contractor. And who he then brings in to do all the other stuff is up to him, is, in broad sense, my understanding, contractor. Now, I would never in a million years go to Hudson Contract and say,
build me a power station.
You've got a few people on your books, get them to build me a power station. So I am never going to
90% of them are chippies and the others are bricklayers.
I'm not going to contract Hudson Contract to build me anything. And yet, even though, if I go to Mace or someone and say, or Vinci and say, build me a skyscraper, they might only have three people on the job. You know, it might just be a terribly sort of, you know, top of the tree managing, pen pushing role, and might not have anyone who actually gets their boots dirty or does anything properly in terms of construction work.
Yeah, pick the bones out of that one. But, the story continues. So we'll keep an eye on it.
Jammy Dodger.
Jammy Dodger? No, not Jammy Dodger.
No, Jaffa Cake. Jaffa Cake.
Yes, now apparently, as you know, this was an argument. I don't know who the manufacturer of Jaffa Cakes is, but it doesn't really matter. They were arguing that it was a cake. The government was arguing, no, it's a biscuit. And the reason they were arguing about it is if it's a cake, it's exempt from VAT.
So biscuits are charged VAT, cakes aren't?
Apparently so, if I've got my figures right. But I think that's true.
Well, it makes perfect sense. Perfect sense.
So, so how do you decide if a Jaffa cake is a Jaffa cake? Is it just the name or is it actually a cake? And this might be an urban myth, but I think the case was decided on the reasoning that when a biscuit goes stale, what happens to it?
It goes into a cake. It becomes
soft. You're nearly there.
Oh, okay.
When a biscuit becomes stale, becomes soft. When a cake is stale, it hardens. So they let a Jaffa cake go stale, and it went soft. So therefore, it's a cake.
No, cake hardens.
No, it went hard. Sorry. See,
hang on. The Jaffa cake went hard, like a
the
cake.
The Jaffa cake went hard rather than soft. So therefore, it's a cake, not a biscuit.
Oh, it's Bake Off last night. There's some pretty disastrous cakes on there. Right.
Okay.
Are we done?
I think we're done. Yeah.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to Reconstruction this week from David and I. It's all we've got time for. But do get in touch with us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk and leave us a review if you want. We welcome those. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk.